You're listening to Season 6 of MGIF, a video game podcast where you listen to me walking around mostly London, having fun, silly chats with people who are involved with or have an interest in video games in one way or another. If, by chance, this gets you thinking about video game culture and its wider place in society, that is not my fault. This week, it's a big one. It's Jane Perry. Jane is an actress who you may know as the voice of Rogue in Cyberpunk, Celine in Returnal, a role for which she won a BAFTA, and Agent 47's handler Diana in the Hitman series reboot. I was so excited to get Jane on the pod because I'm a massive fan. And anyone who knows me knows that Hitman is one of my all-time favourite, beloved game series. So to have Jane on was just incredible. I managed to behave myself and not fanboy out like an idiot at all times. And no, I did not ask her to do the voice. Thank you very much. I was very good. We walked around town with Jane's adorable, enormous Great Dane, Harley. I love Harley.
Harley.
We had a coffee outside in the sunshine before retiring back to her kitchen for a bit more sit-down chat with the fancy mics. Jane is a truly sweet person, so talented, a real pleasure to be in the company of. We had a wonderful chat, intelligent chat about the industry. She's insightful, she's interesting, she's the best. And what a voice, my friends, what a voice. And it's better than my voice, so I'm going to stop using my voice so you can listen to a much better voice. It's Season 6, Episode 9, with the fabulous Jane Perry. Look at this size of my man. He's so great. Yeah. What's the breed? I'm really bad with breeds. Is it like a basset hound?
He's a Great Dane.
Great Dane, of course he's a Great Dane.
Yeah,
sorry.
But he's got that basset hound kind of forlorn look.
Right. yeah, that's it.
Which, personally, I think he just manipulates to no end. He's actually quite happy, but he looks sad, so you're motivated to do nice things for him and give him treats. More treats.
Yeah, that's it. You think, oh, maybe if we give him an extra treat, he'll
smile.
How old is he?
He's 5.
Oh, yeah. You had him the whole time, or?
Yeah, we got him at 12 weeks old, and he was...
He's grown a bit.
He's grown a... Yeah. It was weird because, when he was in training, we had him in a crate, and we'd get up in the morning, and I'd look in the crate, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, he grew overnight. He grew so fast.
Oh, really?
And you could see from one day to the next.
That's amazing.
Yeah, how much he'd grown and changed.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
It's quite a unique experience of that sort of breed of dog as well, right?
Yeah, there's not very many of them around because their size is a little bit challenging just in the sense of transportation. And, of course, because they're much bigger than most dogs, everything is sort of twice as expensive. So if you take it to the vet, it's just, you need 2 times the amount of medication for whatever it is that the issue is, and feeding and all that sort of thing. But whenever we do meet one, he becomes ever so pleased because I think he has trouble finding somebody to play with.
Yeah.
Because he's so big.
Of course, must be so exciting. Hey.
Yeah.
He's like me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, he's a good boy.
You run dog parks nearby and that sort of thing?
Yeah, we're surrounded by really beautiful parks, actually. So I took him down the road to a park this morning and he galloped around there. But there's a lot around here, which is so great about London. There's so many green spaces.
Because you're from Canada originally, is that
correct? Yes, I am.
So what, in terms of like... Were you quite rural out there? I suppose it's mostly countryside, is it, Canada?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Calgary, and, we could be in the mountains in 45 minutes.
Mm.
And then I went to Vancouver after that to study. And the same thing, you could catch a city bus and go skiing in the evening. And
right.
So it's always been a big part of my life, especially the mountains.
Mm.
So I think... Because it was such a significant part of my youth, I feel kind of drawn to it.
Yeah, of course.
As an adult, and feel a real need and an urge to kind of connect to that.
No, I know what you mean. I was I grew up in the lakes, in the Lake District.
Oh, did you?
I was in Manchester till I was about 8 years old or so.
Right.
And then this is back when teletext was a thing.
Yes, right. Back in the day.
Yeah, imagine what? That. Teletext? It's what? It's like the internet just on your TV. Revolutionary. And they were, mum and dad were looking, just looking through houses. I think just bored, you know, just looking on teletext.
Yeah.
And you get a new house come up every, you know, whatever it was, 30, 40 seconds, right, scrolling through the pages. And
yeah.
You just saw one in this little village called Ayerby in the middle of nowhere.
Oh.
And I thought, well, that looks really nice. And they wanted to change. And, yeah, ended up moving there, I think it was about 9 or 10. And, yeah, it's just so, but it's so remote. They had nothing. There was a post box. We had a post box.
That's
that was about
good.
It. One school bus to the school. My school had 30 pupils in it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And so what was that like for you?
It was nice. Like, up until I was about 16, 17.
Right, yeah.
And you're thinking...
See, that's when it gets challenging.
Mm.
I always think of, what do the teenagers do, like, whenever I go somewhere small and tiny?
Yeah.
Because, it's such a different demand, the
yes.
social aspect of things. And I think there's just this huge urge when you're young to get out and do something completely
yeah.
different. And
exactly.
Yeah, so...
It was just getting that itch. It was okay. I wasn't going mad or anything, but
yeah,
you'd have to, if you wanted to see your friends, to go out.
Yeah.
You know, out, as it were.
Right.
It was like a week in advance.
Out to the post box.
Yeah, yeah. I'll see you at the post box.
Connect with the outside world.
Yeah, yeah. I'll bring the snacks. It was a proper, like, one bus an hour sort of thing, and into
right.
the main
yeah.
town, into Lancaster, which took like an hour or more.
Oh, yeah.
If you missed it, you're kind of in trouble.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I had a little bit of that growing up, waiting half an hour for the bus in minus 30 degree
yeah.
sort of weather. But it's amazing what you get used to as well.
Yeah, it really is. I was going to say those rules. Like, and you know someone who used to work at Us Two Games
oh, yes.
called Lauren. She's a previous guest on the show many moons ago. And she's from Texas.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about that difference in what rural means and countryside. And she
yeah.
said, like, she really
yeah.
likes English countryside, but you don't get that sense of emptiness and remoteness that
no.
you might get, like, in Texas, or I imagine, same up in the mountains, that's the vastness,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
If you just kind of, this really is middle of nowhere.
Yeah. And there's a kind of wonderful feeling, but also a slightly frightening feeling associated with being in the mountains and thinking, oh, there really is nobody around. Like, there, it's not... That is true. It's
right.
not just that's what it looks like, but that is the fact.
That is the case.
Just me and the bears and,
yeah.
and the occasional
kind
elk. Let's cross over. We'll see how
to with a little bit more sometimes. Yeah, sure.
This is our little high street.
Nice.
It's, yeah, so as I was saying to you before, it's like nothing's really changed since 1962.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Oh, we got beef.
Let's see what happens here.
It's always the little guys who are...
It's always the little ones, yeah. Hello, Ricky. Yeah. Buongiorno, how are you?
You met him years ago. You
were first met. No, no, don't go in there, Harley. Don't go
He's
in
like,
there.
Wait a minute.
Hello.
It cost you a lot of money if you didn't. Size of this man's mouth.
Yeah.
So, now you've shut up, you know, how big he is.
Yeah, it's like, oh, wait a minute.
That's right. Oh, yes,
how
we've met
you?
Before. Good, how
hey,
are you doing?
I think last time you met was one of the markets when he was still this big.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Aww. He's stepping on your foot.
If you do like that, come on anywhere
yeah,
else.
That's almost 80 pound of dog
just like,
on your toe. Harley, get off his foot. Come on. Come on, you silly dog. Nice to see you.
See you
Take
later.
Care. Ciao. Come on, pups. Come on. Harley. So, can I get you a coffee or hot chocolate or tea or whatever you'd like?
Sounds absolutely delightful.
Yeah.
What should we see? I go decaf because I am.
Yeah.
Being at one this morning and it's getting to that
yeah,
time of life.
I understand.
Or I go, I have
I'm
a second.
Do the same.
Yeah.
I'm going to do the same.
Decaf.
Yeah, for sure. Decaf,
buddies.
Just like a black coffee.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. Thank you so
and
much.
And would you like a biscuit? Hello, how are
Hi.
You? Do you want anything to eat? Got lovely cakes and stuff. Have a look.
Let me have a look. Yeah.
Do you want to see a breakfast
menu? Decaf Americano.
Decaf Americano.
Thank you.
Oat milk, flat white. And I'll have one of these lemon orange cakes, please. Yeah, thank you. Great.
You guys have a seat.
Okay, thank you.
Lovely, thank you.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah. How are you? Yeah, nice to see you. All right, Pops. Good boy.
Look at him.
Yeah.
I love him.
He's special. God,
lying down, he looks like, you know, those huge statues on the fountain, yeah, where they, the couchant lions decorate outside.
I think you're right. And pretty much every day, we'll take
him
out for a walk and we'll always get the comment, oh, he's as big as a horse.
Yeah.
He's as big as an horse. And you're like, yep, that's right. And we hear it about 10 times a day. But yeah, every now and then somebody say, oh, he's like a lion.
Yeah.
He's like a panther. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that? Yeah, I'll take that.
Works. Yeah,
I'll
respond
to that.
That works, yeah.
Yeah. So.
He's like, what? We're talking about you.
We're talking about you, buddy.
Superb.
Lovely, lovely. Lovely, thank you.
Yeah, there's actually a distillery, gin distillery, close to here.
Ooh.
And I mean, this neighborhood, there's kind of nothing here except houses, and then once you live here, you find the nooks and crannies.
Yeah.
You look like you're in love with that coffee.
I know, sorry.
Oh, I lost you for a minute there. He's like, he's gone into his addictive haze. There's all these little interesting little places. And there was an old bakery, an old sort of mill, I think, or bakery, just down a side street.
Okay.
And these chaps took it over and renovated it, and now it's a gin distillery. It's fantastic. It's really, really good. And I think they make rum now, and
Is gin your
spirit
of choice, or
what's
your
thing? I wish it was. I drank far too much gin when I graduated from high school. I got really sick.
And
it's taken me about 30 years to embrace it again. But I'm getting there. I do enjoy a nice gin and tonic, but it took a while.
Mm.
That left a strong imprint. Yeah.
It's one of those moments, isn't it, where you overindulge in one and that's it. Now you can't touch it, you can't look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
The memories.
The memories, yeah, wow. Yeah.
I'm really... bourbon's my thing.
Right. We have a bourbon collection. I'll show it to you when we get back to the house. Because my husband is...
First the coffee, now the bourbon.
Yeah, I know. God, what? I'm bad influence on you. Yeah, my husband loves an old-fashioned, as do I. When he sets his sights on something, he just goes deeply into it,
right.
And he went deeply into bourbon, so consequently every gift that he's had for the past few years is a nice bottle of bourbon, which is absolutely fine.
But
it's lovely, isn't it? But I do like whiskey. I really like Jura. That's my favourite.
Oh yeah,
whiskey. It's beautiful.
It is
the Scottish whiskey. Yeah.
What's that Suntory? You get Suntory whiskey, don't you? Which is the Japanese one.
That's right. That's a gin. Sorry, Roku's a gin.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
Yeah. There's beautiful Japanese whiskies.
Yeah.
I just did a voice ad for Glenlivet Fusion Cask. And when you do an ad, a voice for an ad, you watch the ad over and over and over again. And it's actually a really beautiful ad.
Yeah.
It's really well done. And I have to say, at the end of doing that voice job, I went to the pub because I'd just been talking about Glenlivet Fusion Cask whiskey for an hour, and I was like, I have to have a drink. I need a whiskey.
It worked.
And it did work.
Yeah, that's going to do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's funny. Just staring at the whiskey, and is it one of those sort of super high quality, like slow motion pouring into it? Over some ice and
exactly that, and it's called a fusion cask because it's, I guess it's kept in a wooden barrel that's a combination of rum and bourbon barrels.
Yeah,
like right off the bat, you're like, oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah,
and then it talks about the caramel toffee notes, and you're like, great, count me in. And anyway, they don't sell
you're
it
saying
in this
that mid read.
I know.
Can you?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad you've been complimentary, but can we stay on the script?
Literally just. Hey, you sit down. Just before you came over, I got the first assembly of my games demo reel. I've never had one.
Oh, really?
Because I just didn't really need one. But I have a lovely agent in the States now and in Canada, and they're both requiring this. So I had to go through all of my games work over the past 10 years and sort of harvest bits that I thought might sound good on this reel, which was such a colossal effort, because of course there's so much
footage in games. It's not like going through a few films. It's like going through,
yeah,
you know, whatever, 10.
Finding a moment as well.
Yeah. So I finally did it. And
who does that? So did you just send them the pieces and they bring it together for you?
I actually put it together myself, and then I sent it to some friends of mine, one of whom is a dab hand as an editor. And he was like, yeah, I think it's got a few issues. I'm going to redo it for you.
Cool.
And he just sent that to me. Okay, you go away. So that was fun to hear that. But it's...
That's really, really useful.
It is, yeah. It's great. It's very hard, I think, to be, objective on your own work.
Especially over a 10-year period as well.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
If I look at my work from 10 years ago, there's still things I like from that period, but also things I go, oh, I can see why. You've got to sort of think to yourself, well, that's still useful to have in a portfolio, even though I can see the things I definitely wouldn't do now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you've got to kind of offset that and sort of grit your teeth and go, it's fine. Because you think, well, that isn't bad, but I can see it, but I know it won't necessarily, in this context, that doesn't matter. And you have to sort of, accept that and go, it can be useful in your...
Yes.
What you want to show off now, right?
I think that's exactly it. And I think there can be a kind of tendency to just put everything in the basket and say, look.
Mm.
But, of course, it's too much, yeah. And I think, too, there's always a question, when we're sort of broadcasting to the world what we are and who we are and what we have to offer. There's also this question of, and then also, what do we want? And I would say this to actors, like, so you've got the work that you've done, and that's great, the best of your work, and then what kind of work do you now want to attract? And have you got things in your portfolio that will kind of signify that that's also what you're interested in doing?
Yeah.
And so that's part of the equation, too.
How did you decide on what to put through then?
Yeah, yeah.
Out of all the 10 years of stuff, did you have much stuff from in there from a while ago, or is it more recent? Occasionally I do this. I go and get on the external hard drive from work from ages ago, find the original file, and see, I wonder if I can... It's just more of an exercise, really. I wonder if I can get more out of it and edit it from scratch again and see what big sort of sweeping things that I do that I wouldn't do now and what did I miss, Sometimes it's cool to do that as well.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I pulled material from, from 10 years ago right up to things I've done very, very recently. And I look at, or listen to, rather, the work I've done 10 years ago and I think, oh, yeah, I could have done that better. But it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And, obviously you learn as you go.
Yeah.
And you get better.
It's important not to cringe. Oh, no.
Yeah, it is important, isn't it? It's hard.
It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. But I think games acting has really come a long way, too, in the last decade.
Definitely.
I think things are set up a little to make it a bit easier for actors. And I think also the approach to it is, taken more seriously all around.
Yeah. Mm. Do you remember what the first few things you did were? Like games-wise and...
Yeah.
I'm interested to see how it changed, because I just think about things like, this isn't... Well, actually, no, it is quite long ago. I'm just thinking it isn't, but... think about something like Oblivion, right? Which was an Elder Scrolls game. I think it was a time where they thought, right, we'll just get big people in, and we'll give them the booth, we'll give them the script.
Yeah.
And I think not a lot else, right?
Right.
But they were trying, and it's a long time ago, so I'm not trying to be mean, but they were trying to build that world, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of just... There are even things, I think, no longer in newer versions of the game, but when it came out, there were lines in there where they'd not edited the... someone doing a retake.
No way.
There's a line in there with someone... I'll show you it. I'll find it on my phone.
Wow.
Someone's doing a line, and obviously the subtitles are just the line.
Yeah.
They go halfway through it, and the character goes, oh, sorry, let me do that again.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
And it's things like that are quite fascinating to me, because it's a huge major game.
Yes, yes.
But now it's, I can't remember what year it is, but it must be 15, 20, to approaching 20 years, God.
Well,
15 plus years.
I think there was a time when, voice acting was considered voice over, and therefore much more of a sound effect. is how it was put to me by a game developer when we were talking about this. He said, you know, it's only in recent time that voice acting has been considered acting as opposed to just another sound effect in the audio landscape.
Right.
And I think that is an attitude that has really shifted and changed. And this kind of investment in character and narrative in a really significant way, in a way that really does provide the connective tissue between gameplay and how it can really elevate the game and make a difference. And that's changed a lot. And I think that, you know, also, like, I remember one of the first games I did, which I'm not going to name because I'm really not proud of my work in it, but
sure.
I didn't know. I was being directed by the writer, and it was a female character in a very alpha role. And I kept feeling like the writer, he just wanted me to sort of be angry through the whole thing. And I felt extremely disconnected from my actor self because I was like, well, what's the journey here? What's the character? Yeah. You know, all the questions that you sort of ask. But there was no opportunity to do that because I didn't have a script. It was just the lines. And I was incredibly dependent on the writer to sort of set the scene for me. But the direction was, no, just angrier, harder.
Right, I see. Almost like they were doing a photo shoot rather than a...
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Mm. And I listen back and all I hear is disconnection in my own acting and false anger. Because, of course, you can't just be angry. You have to figure out why you're angry. And there's different ways of being angry. You know, you can have really a low burning intensity, which is extremely powerful. Or you can have an all-out rage. And he wanted it all-out rage through the whole thing. And and the other thing I thought was...
I can imagine the period of this and based on that.
It was... Yeah, I remember walking out of those sessions thinking, God, that was weird. I don't understand this. Mm. And I also sort of felt like, and now this is just pure conjecture, me sort of trying to figure out the situation, but I sort of felt like, I think he wanted a man to play this role. I think that's also what he was looking for, was the mechanisms of power and authority as expressed by a man in that sort of commander sort of position. And and I think women have, not to say that there aren't elements of that you would find in the way that women lead, but I think there is a difference too that perhaps will be more available to a woman playing that role or actually being in that role than to a man. And that to me is really interesting. Like, if you're going to put a woman in a position of power, then let's see how, I mean, surely that's part of making that choice. Let's see how this person deals with things in a different way. Mm. Or perhaps you put a person of color or something that goes against the sort of norm.
Because those cultural elements come into play, whatever they might be.
Absolutely.
And that informs the voice and how you sort of build that character as well and how you do it.
It
as
does,
you say, you
can't
just angry, generic angry. No. So without detail, so devoid of detail, you need so much more than that, don't you?
The best acting is the most specific acting.
Yeah.
And that is true of any piece of art, whether it's writing or painting or...
Yeah.
There's something so specific, because we're so specific as human beings.
Yeah.
When you really start to analyze it, you just think, gosh, there's a myriad of things that we do that are constantly communicating intention or subconscious thoughts or, you know... just attitudes.
Yeah.
They're coming through in all these different ways through our body language, but also definitely through our voice. And that's the pleasure of acting. So when somebody, you know, those years ago, 10, 12 years ago, wasn't sort of present to that, it became really difficult to do that. So that's one of the things I think that has changed a lot, is how performers in games are directed. They bring in proper directors now from theater, film, TV, people who understand script analysis and character arcs and all those things that I was just talking about.
It's huge. It's I've done some work with Ninja Theory in the past and interviewed them, and to me he was the art editor on a lot of Ninja Theory games, and there's a PlayStation 3 game called Heavenly Sword. And they got Andy Serkis in, he tells me that was the first performance capture thing.
Right.
It was certainly the earliest one I can think of.
Yeah.
And that was, they went to Weta to do it, and it's the first game studio that went to Weta and said, look, we're going to do it, we're not going to do this separately, we're going to do the whole thing as one.
Yeah.
So it's a performance, because that's what you need, and they thought really hard about building a world and a story and putting it together, and, you know.
Mm.
And it was kind of, and that's, early PlayStation 3 days.
Right,
so that feels like the sort of the first inklings of someone trying to do it differently, right? And then I think gradually that's bled through. But you need, there's so much budget required and this and that. But that, it's sort of just the message to put out there to say, look, this works better. This is, if that's what we want, if that's what you want in the game you're making. A story and characters, you need to do it like this, or if you can. I mean, it's easier said than done, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think mentioning budget is an important thing, and I think it's sometimes important for us actors to understand the front end costs of things. I mean, of course, there's those big AAA franchises that they do have backing, they've got a lot of money behind them. But then, this is something we do take into account when we do, film, TV, an independent feature film. Any actor who's in an independent feature film will be like, oh, yeah, it's okay to not have enough time. It's okay to not be paid, X amount. Because we understand the parameters of what the filmmaker is dealing with and want to support their vision and what they're doing. And so actors happily will engage with that. Mm. But I think the challenge in games is that you just never know. You don't really know if it's a big, massive budget thing or a small thing. And so sometimes you can feel a bit frustrated. And then you might learn, many, many months after the fact that it was kind of a small game from a independent developer or equally you learn after the fact that it was a huge franchise and you feel a little bit maybe it would have been nice to have a bit more time and work on these things and for the budget to sort of accommodate a process that is more amenable. It'll be really interesting to see how it changes and evolves. It's changing and evolving so much.
Really? Harley's destroyed the table.
That is the sound of Harley attacking the table. Are you a bit restless, buddy?
Should we get back?
We can get moving. That's fine. Is that your called time on this there?
Okay, I've had enough of you two talking. Let's go home. I need to have a nap. I'll get this. I'll be right back.
Oh, thanks, dude.
That's Harley calling time on us. I think we'd better get back to the house.
Well, it's such a vast difference because the game I was telling you about that I did probably 13 years ago now, quite a long time ago. It was just like a kind of, it felt like a wrecking ball approach. Like just put the actor in there, toss a bunch of direction at them and then see what happens. And it was broad strokes, in terms of direction, and the result was, I think, quite broad as well, slightly lacking in nuance. Returnal was, the polar opposite. The Housemarque was absolutely lovely in the sense that they were willing to take a lot of time, to find things and to explore things. And I'd be in the recording session, and there'd be this discussion going on, between the game director, the performance director, and the person who was responsible for the audio aspect of the game. And they would just be sort of chatting, and I'd be like, oh, they're having a conversation. I'm just listening and participating. But I wasn't used to that. Usually the pace of games is so fast.
Yeah.
And a lot of my work in games is sort of, one take.
Right.
And it's like, great, okay, we got that, moving on. And as an actor, you sort of feel like, oh, okay, and you just hope it's good and everything. I think we always crave to have a little bit more time. I love the idea of three takes so you can have a bash at the first one, just sort of get the sense of how it feels to speak the words. And then the second one is a bit more, with a bit more understanding. And the third one, I feel like I, really drop into it.
Mm.
And that was the case with Returnal. There was time to drop in, time to really consider things, and time for me to listen to them talk about what was going on in the scene. And whilst they were talking about it, I was harvesting and mining information that I was directly then, it informed my approach to the scene. And it also gave me a lot of information about what the character was going through. And these conversations are actually fascinating and interesting because the people who might be having the conversation might not realize that they're scattering the seeds of something that might be really interesting in a performance. That without those conversations, you know, the actor wouldn't have the information to build on. So they might say something that's completely in some ways unrelated to the acting per se, which could be about something that's going on in the environment. But of course, we're completely affected by our environment in a very direct way. And I work a lot with environment when I'm acting in games because we are so informed by it, especially in a landscape like Atropos, which is the hostile planet in which Returnal takes place. There's all kinds of things going on that, you know, would affect the way the character breathes, the way she moves, the way she's looking around. And so these things are, you know, interesting. So it was wonderful to have that.
It does, yeah. And that's such a good point in that if you make your performance part of the environment almost, right? Because you want things to match thematically, right? So, you know, there's a lot of work in games across the board. They put a lot of effort into art direction and, you know, your storyboarding and getting a sense of what the environment's going to look like and the themes of it, and, you know, even just the audio effects and things like that, right? And having those things match up, and you're thinking a lot about color palettes and tones and this and that, right? And how the character looks in there. So actually that the performance is just as important, and the voice acting to be an extra ingredient in that, right? And it has to sort of thematically work, and that makes it so much more involving and believable. But yeah, as you said, as I think, is that the games that get it right, and as you say, budget permitting, because more time is more money and more, you know, but when it is able to be done that way, that's when you get these stories that are a little bit more grounded, a bit more believable, the performances are better, and you're drawn in more because they don't feel like an afterthought or a separate thing.
That's it,
right?
Isn't it? Yeah, and I think that's really important. I think that we're quite sorry, this is my dog snoring in the background. Let me just
get some Harley snoring. He literally stopped as you put the mic to him. There he goes. Nice one, Harley.
Anyway, he's clearly bored by our conversation. No, just fast asleep. I think, if we hear something that doesn't ring true, it immediately takes us out. And then we have to, as an audience member, or see something that doesn't make sense or whatever. And I think in games, players are quite accustomed to sort of accommodating that. But I question, you know, in the future, if that will be the case. If I mean, for some games it doesn't matter so much, maybe, you know, because the actual mechanics of the game are much more important than verisimilitude to real life. But there are games that are obviously reaching for that, and if they don't achieve it, I think audiences will have to take a portion of their attention to kind of ignore that.
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah.
And it's interesting because I was saying to you that I was putting together my games demo reel, which means I was going through my work over the past sort of decade plus. And one of the things I really noticed was environment, again, going back to environment, and how some of the things that I said and the way that I said them didn't make sense for the environment or the proximity of perhaps the person I was speaking to, or maybe the vastness, maybe the environment was big and I wasn't projecting, or maybe it was quite small and I was projecting too much. And so I feel like, and I think this is still perhaps slightly an issue. I don't know if it's addressed as much as it could be in games, but for myself as a performer, it's always going to be a question I'm going to ask now, because it's easy to adjust for environment. And yet I don't think we keep that in mind as much as we ought to. I think actors in games are much more inclined to ask, you know, the kind of typical questions that we ask when we're acting, you know, what's my relationship to the person I'm talking to? What do I want out of the scene? What are the given circumstances? Or the classic, what's my motivation? You know, all that sort of thing. But I think game actors, because environment is, you know, it's not part of what we're directly dealing with. That has to be filtered into our imagination. It's not always factored in. And I think it makes a huge, huge difference.
It feels essential to me, I think, to so you know exactly you're placing that character in the world.
Yeah.
You know, that has to happen, really. I think it makes me think of a... So there's a voice line in Dark Souls where there's a shopkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And he... if you choose not to buy anything for him, if you just leave, the line is, oh, throw me a bone, will you?
Yeah.
Throw me a bone, would you? But the guy has clearly never heard that phrase before.
Oh.
So he says it like he's annoyed that you've literally thrown a bone at him. And he goes, oh, throw me a bone, would you?
Oh, I see.
Like, so he just obviously hadn't heard it. So things like that are quite interesting again. And it just, because that game did very well. And there's so much, there's meticulous attention to detail in the environment itself and the way it puts the story together. Mm-hmm. And it's lauded as this very gamey way of telling a story, as in like it uses what's good about a game to tell quite lovely little stories. So mm-hmm. it's a world that's been in ruins for thousands of years, and mm-hmm. you're just picking up, it's almost like an archaeological thing.
Yeah.
You're finding bits and sort of piecing together what happened before, if you want, and if you don't want, you don't have to bother, but it's there if you want.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely way of doing it, right?
Yeah.
And then there's just these little things, and once again, even something like that is so, you know, and to be fair, this is a localization team because it's a Japanese game, but somewhere along the line, that's once again, the voice acting's been kind of cut back on a little bit there, right? We'll just throw that in. He's just, fine, he's just a shopkeeper, but...
Yeah,
it's silly, and you go, what is he saying like that for? You know, just little things. You know, it seems to be the last thing that's being.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not being taken seriously, but the last thing that needs to catch up on how much time and attention you need.
Yes.
To give it.
Well, I know that you know the voice acting. If you're just voicing as opposed to doing performance capture. Comes at the 11th hour, really. It's one of the last things to be added to a game. And you know, for example, Cyberpunk was, they were late, as you might recall, and really under pressure to release this game. And we were sort of in the studio, and then, you know, I can't remember the actual dates, but we were in the studio 1 month and the game was being released rather the following month type thing. It was really quick turnaround.
Wow.
And of course, not all games are under that time pressure, but a lot of them are.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they aren't, it's the voice acting is the last thing that's added. Yeah. Same with lots of things, actually. If you do an ad or whatever, it's the final piece of the puzzle. One of the last pieces that's put together. So I think there can therefore be an element of, oh my God, we have to get this done fast, you know. And I think mistakes like that can sort of happen. And then if you think about the hours that are involved for perhaps a performance director on a localization team, sort of hearing a line like that and just thinking, oh, whatever. Maybe they've asked the actor to do it three times. The actor doesn't really understand.
Yeah.
And they're just like, okay, let's move on. Because they've been in the studio for days and days and days, and they're probably slowly losing their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've certainly seen performance directors like that. Where I remember I was doing, I can't remember what the game was, but there was two performance directors. Oh, no, it was a sound engineer and a performance director. And they had been working on this game for such a long time. And they were up against a deadline. And I looked at them, I thought, these guys they're losing it. They are actually, they're getting delirious. And so the next time I went in, bought them a really beautiful bottle of, I bought the sound engineer a bottle of rum and the director a scotch or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I think you need this. You need this. And don't worry, it's all going to be okay.
Yeah.
So there's that too, you know. I mean, voices is, obviously it's the voice actor, but it's also other people who are around, you know, directly related to that process, who are on that journey with you, but then also the other actors who are in the game. And there's, you know, I mean, obviously Returnal had one actor in it, but that's pretty unusual. Usually games have quite a big cast of characters.
Yeah,
so that's part of the equation too.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. It's always important to remember it is, it really is a group effort. And then within that group effort, it behooves actors to really take responsibility for their own contribution. And this is where I think it is good to understand acting in games. I mean, my belief is that acting is acting. The core principles remain the same. But then what shifts is you change your skill set according to the medium rather that you're working in. So on camera, you harness your on-camera skills and you know how to work with the camera. And stagecraft, same thing. And then same with, you know, acting in games, being behind the microphone for a game has a very specific set of skills.
Yeah.
And I've really learned through my career what those skills are. And it's really nice to be able to teach that to people now, too, because I think those of us who started, you know, in games sort of 10, 15 years ago, we really did learn on the job.
Yeah.
And and now there's a lot of people who, you know, as I was saying to you earlier, specifically, they're really clear that they want their acting career to be in games. And there's people like us who are available to teach them, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not complicated, but it's specific to the medium.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you think your, in terms of your range, if we may speak of your range.
Oh, sure.
if that, do you think that's helped in terms of, or do you think having that necessity to come in last minute and go, right, I've got not much time, and sometimes you say one take, and here's your character, this, to that.
Yeah.
Do you think that helped over the years get you used to doing something different to what you're used to very quickly?
I think so, and I think I realized, funny enough, because I come from a theater background where, you know, we have the luxury of time and sort of, you know, weeks of rehearsal and then months of performance. And I really liked that format. And then games is the complete opposite to that. Absolutely, yeah. The complete opposite. And so I'm slightly surprised that I love it so much. But I realize what I love is it absolutely forces you to be in the moment and to trust your first instincts.
Right.
And that can be a tricky thing. And it's a bit of a conundrum, you know, for actors to sometimes really trust that their first creative impulse is actually exactly where it needs to be.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier about having the chance to sort of give it three goes. But sometimes the more you go, the more takes you have, the more you start to meddle and perhaps even undermine or be clever.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it is that first or second take where that's where the magic is, because you're just simply reacting and being in the moment. So, of course, there's no hard and fast rules. But I felt like I really responded to that highly pressurized environment. And I think I was saying to you prior, you know, when we were arranging this interview, that I have ADHD. It's a recent diagnosis in my life. And I've mentioned this in a couple of interviews, but I began to realize, oh, right, well, that's kind of an ADHD thing, being able to work, like to really come alive in a pressurized sort of crisis moment.
Yeah.
not that it's crisis, but there is this sense of like, we got to get this done. We got to get it done now. And time is of the essence and off you go. And it's one of those moments where I can take on an awful lot of information, and somehow it just lets my creativity kind of unfold. And it really is about being in the zone and being present, which I can find, you know, quite a challenge in other aspects of my life. But there's something about entering that studio where it's like time is moving very quickly, but it slows down at the same time.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird thing. And I really love that.
Mm.
And there's something for me, and I don't mean this to sound mystical, but there's something about acting that is a little mystical to me, in the sense that when we get so involved in a story, the story starts to kind of show up of its own volition. It becomes an entity, a presence in the room, and everybody can start to feel it when that happens, and it is though it comes alive, and that is something that's really exciting to me. And again, I feel this in many different art forms, this experience of being in connection with a creative endeavor, whether it's your own or somebody else's, that when it captures something that's really authentic to our experience, then we recognize it and we respond to it in a way that's really invigorating and interesting and makes us, well, certainly makes me feel kind of recognized or seen or like I'm part of something.
Yeah, know? Working with photography and games as well. Mm. I've had a lot of situations where a lot of that work was, it's not like a magazine shoot where you go, the journalist will meet the interviewee on one day, do all that. And then on another day, the photographer will come and have 5 hours and costumes and da-da-da.
Yes.
It was, you go along with the guy during the interview.
Right.
And at the end, the PR will try and tell you you don't need a photo. Oh. And you have to, no, we do. And then you have literally 5 minutes and, I don't know, whatever this hotel room is.
Right.
To get something, right?
Yeah.
And it's a similar kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
But being used to that now and doing that, it has been really beneficial, and you can create something out of nothing most of the time.
Yeah.
You never feel relaxed ever.
No.
But hey, whatever. I simultaneously quite enjoy working like that.
Yeah.
And it is that last minute that you, and as you're talking about that moment of creativity, which I love making things, of having a bit of a plan, but it's what comes out of it's the seeds, it's the ingredients, and it's what comes out of it, right? What germinates that you go, oh, look at that. Oh,
yeah,
okay. And then and then you start to work reactively with what comes about that no one explicitly intended. And that's what's, as you say, sort of magical about the process, because, well, no one specifically said this is going to happen, but between us, some things appeared, right? Yeah.
That's it, isn't it?
And it is really cool. And that's what I find so addictive about it, and something that's never get tired of, right?
I totally agree with you, and it's like stepping into the unknown and just trusting that if you don't have to have all the answers, you don't have to be in complete control, you can step into this sort of nebulous space and something interesting will come out of it. And I think that's why you know getting back to that conversation about being directed by somebody who maybe didn't understand the actor's process and sort of being told, no, I need this reading on this line, sort of feeling kind of bridled by that and not being allowed to step into the unknown to just see what's there sort of turning around in the mud. I just thought, well, that's a missed opportunity, you know, to work with an actor that way. Or
definitely.
And yeah, it lacks collaboration, and I think collaboration is just so great. It's where it's at. It's so interesting.
For sure.
Yeah.
It is like I say, I don't know enough. I'm always on the enthusiast side of looking at how games are made. I did a 3-year like embedded photojournalism thing with the first two games. I went in initially every week and then sort of scattered it after that, but staggered it, I mean. Where you watch them making something.
Yeah.
And I still don't really know how
right.
I do. Do you know what I mean? Yes. I'm just sort of going, oh, so now that's okay.
Yeah.
Like, as you know, I've seen, you know, even then I think you have to actually go and do it to sort of I always hesitate to, if anything, it makes me hesitate further to go, oh no, this is really, it's mad anything gets made or how you've managed to put it together. I don't understand. That's crazy. But like, I just think however it needs to happen, that AAA budget thing where you've got a mocap studio in your office because you've got lots of money and, you know, and time to get this right and do this, and people are acting as directors and as in being directors, not acting, and you know, and people come in and you do performance captures and it's a back and forth and it's lots of time, just like a film set, it's like a TV thing, right? A version of that needs to trickle down to games with not as much budget as that, where they want to have a good performance in their indie game or whatever, where you can afford to bring people in. Same with the writers as well. Bring them in, write something, start making the game, bring them back and say, we had to do this and that, and then adjusting and molding it around there, because you can't just do one big plop of...
Yes, one big plop.
One big plop of yeah. story no, or acting, yeah, you know.
Yeah,
it needs that.
It does. It needs a little bit of breathing room. And sometimes you don't know if something works until you try it. And then the truth of the matter reveals itself. And you realize, oh, actually, that doesn't work. That's underwritten or that's overwritten. Or the actor needs to take a different approach. Or they're not quite, you know, whatever. There's a whole bunch of things that... perhaps are just not quite there, and with a little bit of tweaking they can arrive there, but you know, I guess this is something that, you know, watch this space, we'll see what happens in terms of where games go and how time is organized. I think there's a little bit right now of probably with a lot of aspects of games, but certainly the one I'm familiar with is the acting side of it.
Yeah.
There's a sense of, well, this is how we've always done things, so this is how we'll continue to do things. But in some ways, that statement is ridiculous in a medium that is so young and is actually transforming sort of daily in a way. And so I think that there's lots of room to sort of figure out new ways of doing things. And there's, you know, obviously issues in games with this whole idea of crunch, with all the layoffs that are happening. There's something that's not quite right.
Yeah.
It's a hugely exciting, I think, industry to be a part of. But it also feels to me quite dangerous. Like, I think if I was a young coder learning those skills right now, I'd be like, oh, right.
Yeah.
Is this going to be okay?
Yeah.
Because it's not been great, you know.
No.
It's been pretty awful.
I think it's this thing, as I was saying before with games, that the technology and just the amount of money it's making, the growth financially, is far outracing the artistic and other sides of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard. It's going to be hard for that to marry up, I think. So it is the case of risk. So if this is how we've always done it, it's worked plenty so far. That is the lowest risk you can do. If you're making this gigantic game that needs to sell so many, that because of that success, it's going to make it harder to play around and innovate.
Absolutely.
It's too dangerous.
It's too dangerous, isn't it? And that scope and that the you know, when it comes to that sort of level of investment, it, you know, there's a certain amount of conservatism that arrives with that expectation. And I suppose that's always the challenge with everything, really. You know, when you talk about innovation, that's by nature a risk-taking activity. And how do we balance that with, you know, the huge demand? I mean, everybody talks about the money in games, right? The billions and the fact that it overtakes entertainment, sport combined. Yeah. And, you know, that famous sort of statistic that's always rolled out.
They love doing that, yeah.
And I just look and I'm like, gosh, this is so curious to me, because there's, again, you know, we hear that and then you hear about all the layoffs and I just think, what's really going on here? And how is this profit all sort of divided up? How does it work as a business model? And this is interesting to me, because as an actor, like for the longest time as an actor in games, I was just, well, I'm just an actor in games. I don't really understand what the hell's going on. I know my little bit really well, but otherwise I don't know. And I'm feeling like, actually, I'd like to know. I'd like to talk to developers more and really understand what they do and really understand how the whole thing works. Because it's useful to have that information if you're part of a creative process, rather than feeling siloed, to really have an understanding of what's going on.
Well, as you say, even with that Returnal experience, you were gleaning information that you're almost eavesdropping, right?
Yes, that's right.
Rather than going, right, so try this and try that, you know, because you know what you're doing, and obviously you know what to do. You know what to listen for, you know, and that's interesting. But I know that you are trying to get into starting to play some games now. And do you think that, I mean, in terms of getting that side of an understanding of it, that might also help
you
in a future performance, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think, I mean, it's a funny thing, because I feel, as I said before, acting is acting. And in some ways you don't have to know I think you have to know about games. You have to understand certain key things. And then the rest of it is just acting. So you can get by acting in games without having a vast understanding of games, or perhaps not having played loads of games. Mm. But I think increasingly for myself, it's generating a very deep interest, and I want to have a holistic experience of it, not just as an actor anymore, but really as a player, and maybe as, I'm not suggesting I'm a writer or a game developer, that I have aspirations that way, but who knows, because that you're starting to see actors, you know, cross over that threshold into being developers, like Abubakar Salim, for example, wonderful voice actor. And he's started up his own production company, Sargent Studios. And he's an amazing, you know, actor and a lifelong gamer. Mm-hmm. And now he's making games. Yeah. And I just think, okay, well, let's watch Abu and see what he's doing, because there's only a small handful, I think, of actors who've done that.
Yeah.
But I think when you think of, I'm conscious of the fact I've spoken a lot about creativity during our conversation here. And I think there's, you know, as an actor, you can sort of bump up against the ceiling of creativity because you're interpreting, it's an interpretive art form. You're interpreting somebody else's writing, somebody else's character, you know, and you breathe life into that. But it's ultimately not completely your creation. And I feel really engaged by learning more about creative processes that are not just to do with acting and to understand that better. And I think games are, I'm just so fascinated to see where they're going to go and what they're going to do and who's going to be playing them, you know, in 10 years time.
Yeah.
Because I think there's, of course, loads of gamers out there, but there's lots of people who don't play games. And that shift is going to start to happen, you know, where there's going to be more and more people who maybe would never have thought of it.
Yes.
Who are going to be like, oh, yeah, I would like to spend my evening doing that. Let's do that. Yeah. And let's do it together, or do it with a family, or whatever. Yeah.
Or even just people sort of go, there's another version where they go, oh, wait, no, I do play them, don't I?
Yeah, right.
But it's just sort of, there's another weird culture of, oh, you don't play games. Yeah. You play games. You know, that's another thing. But that's another, you go, oh, wait, no, I've played that. Oh, yeah, I guess I have played that.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, I guess I do. So yeah, I might try that. And
that's
right,
yeah.
But how have you been finding it in terms of, we find the time itself for a start, because
that has been the biggest thing. And I think the past 3 years have been super busy with various things. And I'm really just at a point right now where I'm like, in with intentionality, carving out space for myself to A, play games, and to B, just kind of, like, for example, I got my master's degree. When did I graduate? I guess I graduated a year ago. And that was also the time when I won my BAFTA. And then there was a whole bunch of other things going on in the industry at that time that I was quite involved in. And I really had no time whatsoever.
Yeah.
So what I want to do now is just process everything, read those books I didn't have time to read. And I've got a stack of books on my shelf about games, writing in games and making games. And that's part of it.
Yeah.
And playing games is a part of that too. And I think for me, I have always struggled with downtime, and maybe this is a function of being self-employed, or just, I don't know, because I know a lot of self-employed freelancers play games and find lots of time to relax, but I've always had trouble relaxing doing things that maybe take hours that are just really for the sheer pleasure of doing them. So that's my New Year's resolution, is to just like, okay, just put aside all the busyness of life and challenge this issue that I'm having around time, which we spoke about earlier, always feeling like I don't have enough time. Yeah. I don't have enough time to play games, and games take a lot of time. So I'm going to just put that off until I'm 85 and I have a bit more time on my hands. And so I'm trying to not put my life off, you know, to my 80s when I'm on my deathbed and actually doing these things that are wonderful and pleasurable now and
absolutely
challenging time and saying, actually, no, I do have enough time to do these things, and so that's what I'm doing.
I think it's hard when you're a freelancer, because this is a previous guest, I feel this is myself as well, but previous guest on the show, Bilal Zafar, he's the same. He, when I spoke to him about it, he said, I just feel like, because he's freelance and he does lots of things and he's doing his, you know, writing stand-up, or he might want to write a script, or if he wants to write a film, he wants to, you know, you can, in the back of your head, there's a voice that goes, but you could always be using this time to do more projects, work on this, you've got work on that, you've got going, especially if you're the kind of freelancer who's like just got lots of things that you are either are doing or could be doing.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's really hard because you don't have that cutoff.
Yeah.
Because, I could do some work right now. Wow. I've woken up early at 6, I'll do some now in the morning before the kids get up, I'll do some tonight, I'll do some at lunch, I'll do, and then the usual hours, or I might do that. You know, you could always just do some work on something.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing about it. And to go, I'll sit down and play something.
Yeah.
You have to, I guess that's why with artists as well, you have that, what's the official term for it? There's a term for it, I can't remember. But it's when you just sit maybe for a week and soak in.
Yeah.
You watch loads of films.
Yeah.
You read loads of books. You
yeah.
And it's study of a sort, but you're and pulling it in.
It's very important.
Yeah.
And I think I have decided to remind myself that has to be a part of the equation. Like, for example, you know, most writers spend a good chunk of their time reading. Like, they might have a little writer's shack or a shed or something. And in that shack or shed, there'll be an armchair and a light where they can sit and read. And and I think that's true for everybody. We have to take the time to do that. And I will say, like, you know, I was on the jury for BAFTA last year. And so I did have to play games. And of course, it was a slightly frustrating process because I'm not very good at them. But I had to play them to engage with the performances that I was considering. And I was able to do that. And I would also watch other people play the games too when I wasn't that good at it, so that I could get a sense of fluency with the game in question and the performance. And I was, you know, at a certain point I was like, oh, this is quite good. Like, this is kind of a job I've been asked to do, and I have to do it. And actually, it's amazing.
You get the feeling
slightly guilty.
Yeah.
I like this.